Hello, and welcome to the Manor Geog Pod, a revision podcast for students sitting the OCRB GCSE Geography paper in January 2012. This podcast is designed as a guide for those sitting the Sustainable Decision Making exercise on the 24th of January 2012, which has the title of A Damming Report, Why Are Some Strategies for Flood Management More Sustainable Than Others? First of all, I'll introduce myself. My name's Mark Howell, and I'm a geography teacher from a school in Northamptonshire in England. And I've been teaching the Sustainable Decision-Making Exercise exam now for a few years. This is actually the third of these podcasts that I've done, and I'd like to start by thanking everyone who downloaded, promoted, or reviewed either of the first two. The response to those first two podcasts in this series was overwhelming, and I was really pleased with the number of people who downloaded it and the number of people who gave a positive response to it. So thank you to those people. This podcast is designed as a way for students to revise for this exam, which has very specific demands outside of the classroom. As most of you will know, this exam comes with a pre-release booklet and allows you 3 weeks' worth of preparation before you sit the exam on the 24th. Now, obviously, with any 3 weeks' preparation, that doesn't allow your teacher an awful lot of time to prepare you for the exam. So I imagine for most students, you'll have spent the weeks building up to this, learning about and revising rivers and flooding processes and various flooding case studies. So you'll have a wealth of knowledge to back you up. But what this podcast should do is allow just a little bit of extra input for students who are looking to add to whatever the teacher may have taught them in class, just to help you with revision. I found in previous years that there's been an awful lot of students who have got value out of listening to this podcast who maybe ordinarily wouldn't do any or wouldn't do a lot of revision, and they have found that this podcast has enabled them to do something. So what I'll do is take you through each of the resources that may be used in this exam, go through making sure you understand them, and going through some of the questions that you might be asked about each of these resources, so you've got an idea about how you're going to be assessed. Now, the most helpful thing is if you can have your pre-release booklet in front of you whilst you're listening to this podcast, and then when I'm referring to the resources, you can be actually looking at them while I'm talking about them. One problem with this is that one of the instructions on the front of the booklet, if you have it in front of you, says that this booklet must be handed to your teacher at the end of each lesson. And so in most cases, I would imagine in all cases, your teacher will insist on taking this booklet off you before the end of the lesson. However, an electronic copy of this booklet is openly available on the internet, and so I advise that you print off a copy or be looking at a digital copy on your computer while I'm talking to you. The best way to find that is if you go to Google and type in OCRB Geography, click on the top link, and you'll be taken to the OCR exam board website. If you scroll down the page where it has the various documents associated with the course, scroll down to near the bottom and you'll see a section of documents called pre-release material. If you click on the second one, which says unit B561/01/02, that is the resource booklet for your exam January 2012. And if you click on that and open it, it'll give you a full color digital version of this January's pre-release paper, and either look at that while I'm talking to you or potentially print off a copy for you to use while I go through this podcast. So what I'll now do is go through each resource in turn, talk a little bit to you about what it all means, and talk to you about some of the questions that they might ask about each of these resources. So if I start at the beginning, which is resource one, which is best if you look at the double page, and we're given information about two drainage basins, drainage basin A and drainage basin B. Now, I'll start by sort of briefly explaining what a drainage basin is. I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast will know that, but it's worth just reiterating. A drainage basin is an area of land drained by a river. So what that means is that any drop of rain or water that lands in that basin will end up in the river, which is associated with that basin, and will follow that river's course and eventually end up out at sea. And every river has a drainage basin, and more or less every point on Earth is part of a drainage basin. If you imagine it like the hand basin in your bathroom, any drop of water that lands in that basin will end up falling eventually through the plug at the bottom of that basin. If there's another basin next to your hand basin in the bathroom, maybe you've got a his and hers setup going on, well, any water that lands in that other drainage basin, that other hand basin, will be drained through that plug. And rivers are the same. So every river has its drainage basin. Any water landing on it will end up in that river. Any water landing in an adjacent or a different drainage basin will end up being drained by a different river. So we've got two drainage basins here, and information about the two. We've also got two storm hydrographs which are attached to each drainage basin. I'll start by explaining what a storm hydrograph is, and I'm sort of looking at drainage basin A here as I talk about it. A storm hydrograph shows two things. It shows, firstly, the details about a storm event, and secondly, it shows how the river has responded to that storm event. So if we look at drainage basin A here and the storm hydrograph attached to it, we can see at the top we've got what is basically a bar graph, an upside down bar graph. And what it shows is the amount of rainfall in millimetres that fell during various time periods. Now that bar graph looks fairly simple at first glance, but it's actually a little more complicated than that, and I'll come on to explain why in a moment. But more or less, you can read off those various bars and read off to the side to the left there, and you can see how much rain fell in that time period. Now below it, we can see how the river responded to that rainfall event. And so along the bottom, we've got time in hours, and along the side, we've got the discharge in cubic meters per second, or cumex. And so what that shows is how much water, how many cubes of water are passing through that river every second. So if we just take hour one, for example, if you look at your storm hydrograph for drainage basin A and look at where it says hour one and read upwards, you can see that it's roughly sort of, what would we say, one and two thirds, 1 3/4 cumex per second that it is flowing at after 1 hour. Now these hydrographs tell us an awful lot about a river and its drainage basin, because by looking at the how quickly the discharge changes in a river, and by looking at how severely it changes, that'll tell us an awful lot about the surrounding area. And so if we look at, again, looking at drainage basin A, we can see that this river responds quite severely to this rainfall event. It rises from just over 1 cubic meter per second, a meter cubed of water per second, to 14 cubic meters per second in 3 hours on this hydrograph. And even more detailed, from the peak rainfall to the peak discharge is a period of only 2 hours, and you can see that at the top there where it says lag time. So lag time is our key word here. The lag time is the delay between peak rainfall and peak discharge, and so in this case it's only 2 hours. So just 2 hours after the rain fell at its most heaviest, the discharge of the river was at its highest, and that's very quick. And that shows us that for whatever reason, the rainfall in this area on this drainage basin found its way into that river very, very quickly. Now what we also see on the graph there is two labels. We've got a rising limb and a falling limb. So the rising limb is the period of time during which the water level was increasing, and the falling limb here is the period of time for which the water in the river was decreasing. And so both of those are very steep. They happen very quickly. So here's a river at drainage basin A that had a rainfall event. It peaked 1 hour into our hydrograph, and 2 hours later, so that's on 3 hours, the river was at its maximum discharge. This is almost what we call a flash flood. In fact, it is what we call a flash flood, a very quick response. Now, there's also a photograph and a map associated with drainage basin A, which give us some clues as to why this might happen. If you look at your photograph for drainage basin A, you'll see that this is an area of in the hills, in the mountains possibly, and we can see that it's very undulating land. The relief here is very steep. In fact, this is a feature known as a V-shaped valley. Okay, it's pretty obvious looking at it why it's called that. It's clearly, if you were to do a cross section of this piece of land, it is a V-shaped with the river. In fact, you can't even see the river. The river is a small stream at the bottom of that V-shape. If we look below that, we can even see an OS map of this area, and there's a little star and an arrow on this OS map which indicate where the photo was taken and the direction. And sure enough, those of you who are particularly good at reading OS maps will see that this feature is clearly a V-shaped mallee. The OS map confirms that that is the case. Now, anyone who's not particularly good at reading OS maps, and I think about some of the students I teach, and some panic when they see an OS map on an exam paper. Anyone who's not particularly good is shouldn't worry. There's not going to be a question on this exam which tests your map reading skills, or at least that's very, very unlikely. And if there is one, it's going to be for one, maybe two marks at the most. So if you're not brilliant at OS reading OS maps, what I'm not going to do at this stage is go through how to read it. What you do need to know is that this map shows and clearly can be interpreted to show that this is a V-shaped valley. Now, clearly, if it's a V-shaped valley, think about the shape of the V. If any water lands on a V shape, it's going to be channeled very quickly to the bottom of that V. It's going to find its way there very, very quickly. And that is the major piece of evidence here as to why this hydrograph responds in this way. If we go back to our hydrograph, we can see that it floods very quickly. Short lag time, steep rising limb. And this is because of this V shape, because water finds its way onto the V and very quickly gets channeled to the bottom. So in a question that asks you, why do you suppose, or what evidence is there in the photograph to suggest why this was a flash flood, or why this flash flood occurred, you can use the feature itself. The V-shapeness of the valley, steep sides, means it's going to channel water to the bottom very, very quickly. Now, we've also got, of course, Drainage Basin B, which is in contrast to Drainage Basin A. It's quite a different hydrograph. Again, at the top, we've got the rainfall, which is a little more difficult to interpret. But what we can see is that the bars are of similar length to the bars in hydrograph A, in that the peak rainfall is just under 30 millimeters, just like hydrograph A. So the peak amount of rain was quite similar to hydrograph A. In B, we can see that the rain fell for perhaps a slightly longer period of time. But in general, the two rainfalls are quite similar. And this is important because actually what we can see is that although both rivers had a similar amount of rain fall on them, the responses are very different. Okay, it would be quite an unfair test to have one river where we put a load of rain on it and another river where we put just a small amount of rain on it. So we can be sure here that these two rivers are responding to a similar amount of rain. However, when we look at the hydrograph below, we can see that this river responds very, very differently to Drainage Basin A. It has a rising limb and a falling limb, just like on A. However, they're a lot more shallow and a lot more prolonged. So the rising limb goes from sort of very early on in the hydrograph, you know, we can see that the rainfall started after maybe 40, 45 minutes. And the peak rainfall was in an hour and 12 minutes. Each of those blocks, each of those markings along the time axis indicate 12 minutes. So we can see that the peak rainfall was after an hour and 12 minutes. The peak discharge didn't occur until about 5 hours and 6 minutes, 5 hours and 5 minutes. So the lag time here is several hours. In the first case of Drainage Basin A, we had only a 2 hour lag time. In this case, we've got just under a 4 hour lag time. In fact, it's somewhere near 3 hours and 55 minutes, this lag time. So a very, very long time it took the water here, the rain, to find its way into this river. Now, again, we're looking for evidence here as to why this might have happened. And thankfully, they provide us with, again, a photograph and an OS map, which give us clues as to why this might have occurred. And straight away, we can see that if we just look at the photograph, first of all, this is a very different landscape to the one we saw in Drainage Basin A. The big difference here being vegetation, trees and plants. In Drainage Basin A, we can see some grass there, but grass is quite thin, it's quite small, it's quite short. And so when rain falls on grass, okay, the grass catches some of it, it soaks up some of it, but not a significant amount, not enough to delay the water getting into the river. Whereas in Drainage Basin A, we can clearly see this is a forest or a wooded area, and it's covered in trees and that kind of thing. Now, trees catch an awful lot of water and prevent it from ever reaching the ground. This is known as interception. Okay, so when you cover an area with trees, a lot of those trees will intercept an awful lot of the rainwater and stop it from reaching the ground. And if it never reaches the ground, it's never going to reach the river. So what this means is that when we're looking at our hydrograph, there's an awful lot of water in the rainfall that never finds its way into the river and therefore never finds its way onto the bottom graph there. It only appears on the rainfall bar graph at the top. So trees in an area, they intercept water. They also, of course, their roots soak some of it up. So some of the water that does find its way to the ground is then soaked up by the trees. Some of the water that lands on the trees is evaporated back off into the atmosphere. And this is a process known as transpiration. Okay, so again, there's more water that never finds its way to the ground or to the river. And some of the water that does find its way to the river has got there through a series of other processes. So it lands on the leaf of the tree. It then runs down the leaf and the stem of that tree. That's what's known as stem and drip flow. Okay, it then finds its way to the ground. Some of it's soaked up. Some of it does find its way into the river. But this is a long and drawn out process. Okay, so what we can see is that by covering an area in trees, we are delaying the flood and making the flood less severe when it comes. Now, we've also got an OS map of this area to give us some clues as to why this area floods quite slowly, although we think we might know that already. Again, we've got a little star and an arrow to indicate where the photo was taken and the direction it was taken in. And we can see, sure enough, if we look at this map, the area is covered with evergreen trees, so Christmas trees, if you like. Christmas trees are actually very good at intercepting water. They intercept an awful lot of water. If you think about a Christmas tree, particularly this time of year, I'm sure it's in your memory, it's covered in small spines. If you were to look down onto a Christmas tree, you would be able to see very little of the ground below because it's absolutely covered in these pines, in these little sort of spikes. And so it would be very hard for a raindrop to find its way through that tree without being intercepted. Okay, and so Christmas trees, evergreen trees, are very good at intercepting. Now, what is interesting about this OS map is that we can see a lot of contour lines on here. And actually, we can see that this, is, again, like Drainage Basin A, is a valley, perhaps not as steep as the valley in Drainage Basin A, but still, nonetheless, quite a steep valley. So we would think that just like in Drainage Basin A, the rainwater would be channeled into the valley very quickly. But of course, we know that covering it in trees increases things like interception. And so actually, the fact that it's a valley is sort of insignificant because a lot of the water isn't given a chance to land on the ground and therefore be channeled in. So two very different drainage basins in A and B. One in A that is covered only by grasses, okay, and so not a lot of interception or transpiration or stem and drip flow. Most of the water finds its way into the river and, because of the V-shaped valley, finds its way in very quickly. Drainage Basin B, on the other hand, is again a valley situation, but this valley is covered with trees and other plants which delay the water getting into the river. They catch a lot of the rainwater and intercept it and stop that from happening. And as a result, we've got a less severe flood and a longer lag time. Now, of course, you want to know what sort of questions am I going to be asked here. Well, what's very, very likely is that you will be asked to interpret these graphs for one, maybe two marks, a simple data interpretation question. So what you need to be able to do is make sure you fully understand what these graphs are showing. So you might get questions like, after how many hours did peak discharge occur on the two rivers? So obviously the first one, you need to be able to read that off, right? Peak discharge is at 14 cumex, so that's 3 hours. On Drainage Basin B, peak discharge 4 cumex, that's after 5 hours, 5 minutes. Okay, and so you need to be able to make sure you can read off these graphs and interpret any of the data that they require from you. Now, possibly for more difficult marks, they're going to ask why. Why was the lag time greater on Drainage Basin B than A? Explain why this has taken longer at B than A, or describe the reasons why. And you need to have done some work in your mind and in your lessons understanding what these various command words mean. So if a question asks you to explain why Drainage Basin A flooded more slowly, the word explain means tell me why it's happened. Give reasons for. It means you're going to have to write a paragraph, make two or three points. It's not just, you can't get away with bullet points if it says explain. Okay, whereas a question that maybe says state or list some reasons why, then you can get away with just one word answers, but that's going to be worth less marks. So for example, what you might see here is a question that says state one reason why Drainage Basin B flooded more slowly, and so you could put simply tree cover. However, if a question said explain why Drainage Basin B flooded more slowly, it would perhaps be for more marks, maybe four rather than one, and you would need to write a paragraph or so. Okay, so we plant, so trees are there, but what does that do? And then you would need to discuss, right, trees intercept a lot of the water. These are evergreen trees, so in particular, they're very good at interception. They'll also soak up water through their roots. The stem and drip flow will also occur, and all these things slow down the rate at which water gets into the river. And so the end result is a flood which is less severe and takes a longer time to occur. Okay, so that's resource one. I'm going to move swiftly on to resource two. So resource two is broken into two parts, 2A and 2B, and actually I think it potentially sits alongside resource three. So perhaps open up on that double page and be looking at both, but focus for the minute on resource two. Resource 2A just simply gives us three definitions. Now, if the exam board are giving you definitions, that's because they want you to use them. Perhaps not necessarily at this stage in the exam, but certainly when you come to the essay question later on, you're going to want to use these kind of words. So they give you three definitions. The first is flood risk, and that is the probability of a flood happening. So how likely is it that a flood is going to happen? Doesn't matter how severe it is, it's just how likely is it to happen. So a 1 in 1,000 year flood has a low risk, it's unlikely to happen. Whereas a flood that happens every year has a very high risk and is very likely to happen. The second definition is a flood hazard, and that is a flood which can threaten life and property. The important thing to note is here, if something is a hazard, it means it could happen. It means that it might happen in the future. It hasn't necessarily happened yet, but we can see that there might be a problem. And so if you live by a river, there is a hazard that you might get flooded at some point and there might be damage to your life or to property. In contrast, we've got the final definition, which is a flood disaster. And this is when it has happened. So it's a flood that causes death and or damage. And that is caused when a flood happens. But that's the important distinction between a hazard and a disaster. A hazard is a theory. It might happen. We can look at a place and go, there's a hazard of this. Whereas a disaster is something that has happened and has caused damage and has caused a problem. Now below, we've got a risk assessment grid. If we look at 2B, and in this risk assessment grid, risks can be divided into four categories. So what we would do is look at a flood potentially and decide how likely is it to happen, and how bad would it be if it did happen. And so we can then put it somewhere in this grid. All right, so we might decide that there is a river somewhere that is very unlikely to flood, and it's in the middle of nowhere, and if it does flood, it's not a problem. And so it would go somewhere in that bottom left hand square. It would have a very low probability and a very low impact of happening if it did happen. Whereas, let's say the Thames in London, that would have a big impact if that flooded. Okay, and so that would go somewhere higher on this grid, somewhere towards the top of the increasing impact. Now, if we were to take the example of the Ganges River in Bangladesh, this is a river that floods almost annually and has a very big impact when it does. And so this is going to go somewhere in the top right-hand corner of this grid. It's a very high probability that it will happen, and it's got a very high impact. And so this is what's known as a risk assessment. When you live in an area that could potentially be impacted by a flood, you would consider how likely is it the flood will happen, and how bad would it be if it does happen. And if you decide that the probability is high and the impact is very high, well, you need to think about taking steps to prevent the flood from happening. Now, I think this sits with resource three, and you'll see why in a moment. The two go very nicely together. If we look at resource three quickly, we've got two sketch diagrams or two sketch maps of two areas, area one and area two. If we look at area one, we're told a few things about this area. We're told that there is a dam, there is a reservoir, of course, created by the dam. So the dam's been built, blocked the river, and behind it, a reservoir has formed. There is a small village and a forest. Now, you will have done some work prior to this exam on various techniques for preventing flooding. And you'll know that one of those techniques is a dam. By building a dam, we block the river, we create a reservoir behind it, which floods some land, but it's a known flood, it's a planned flood. And we create an artificial lake, and we know it's going to be there, so we can evacuate people and rehome people. But what a dam does, once it's been built, is allow us to control the rate of flow on the river below it. So we can either open the floodgates or close the floodgates to allow more or less water to come through that dam. And by doing this, this can control a flood. So if a lot of water falls on area one, we can just close the gates on the dam, let the reservoir fill up, and the area below the dam will be unlikely to flood. Looking at area one, we've also got a forest, which, as we know from resource one, helps to prevent flooding because obviously the trees will intercept the water. And we've also got a small village there. And if we relate this back to our resource two, we would say that this area had a low probability of flooding because of the trees and the dam stopping the flood from happening. And we would say that this area had a low impact if there was to be a flood. There's just a small village. And if it floods, is it that significant? Probably not. So the hazard here is quite low. The risk is quite low. It's unlikely to happen, and it's not a big hazard. It's not a big problem. In contrast, we've got area two. Now, area two is got a deforested area up in the mountains, so the trees have been chopped away, and this means that any water falling there is going to very quickly find its way into the river, a bit like we saw in drainage basin A on the resource one. We've then got a large town, power stations and factories, and no flood defences that we can see. So what we know about this is that water that lands on area two is going to find its way into the river very quickly, create maybe a flash flood. And what's it going to flood? Well, a large town, a power station and some factories, all of which is going to create massive loss of life, massive loss of property and damage to businesses and even a power station. So again, looking back at resource two, this is an area that has a very high probability of flooding and a very high impact if it does flood. So the risk here is very high and the hazard is potentially very high, and this could create a disaster. So again, for you, what's important is, what am I going to be asked here? And I think there's quite a few things that might come up. The first is that you might be asked, just using resource two, to talk about the difference between a hazard and a disaster. You might be asked to interpret, how could a hazard become a disaster? And so you need to talk about the fact again that a hazard is a potential, it could happen, whereas disaster is saying that has happened looking back. And so for one to become the other, it needs to have actually occurred. The hazard needs to have actually happened. The flood has happened and created deaths, damage or injury. Okay, so that's one thing you could be asked. You could be also asked to relate the two. So you could be asked to suggest why the hazard is greater in area two than in area one. And so you need to talk about the things we just mentioned, the forest and the dam in area one that prevent it, and the fact that in area two, the flood is more likely to happen and it's a greater probability if it does happen. And you'd want to relate that to 2B. So you'd want to say in your answer that area two has a high probability and a high impact and is therefore going to be more likely to be a disaster than if a flood occurs in area one. Linking to that, you might also be asked questions about, why is the risk of flood greater in area two than in area one? And again, you want to talk about the things we've just mentioned, or why is the probability of a flood greater in area two or area one? Or why is there a greater flood hazard in area two or area one? Or you might be asked to explain one factor, which means that area one is not considered to have a great flood hazard, or that area two is considered to have a great flood hazard. So here, guys, it's about understanding the key terms, understanding this kind of risk assessment grid that we've got here, and understanding these two sketch diagrams and the differences between these two areas and how these two areas are likely to respond in the event of a flood. So then we get to resource four. So if you turn your booklet over, you'll see that. And it is a floodplain hazard zone diagram. And what it shows is in an ideal world, what the best practice would be with regards to where we put various land uses around a river, so that in the event of a flood, certain land uses are protected whilst others can absorb the damage. So what we see is a river in the middle of the diagram with its normal water level. And then around that, we see the area that would be flooded by a flood that might happen every so many years. So if we look at the first bracket, if you like, you can see that in an event which happens every 25 years, so quite a regular flood, there is nothing that is impacted really. None of these land uses would fall into that area. Looking at the next category, a 1 in 50 years flood would potentially flood things like golf courses. So this is going to be land that is nobody lives on it. Okay, it's a place of business, but it's not high value land. It's open spaces. Potentially, we can make sure the golf course is closed if we know that there's a flood warning, so that nobody gets harmed or injured. Potentially, even we can look to compensate the golf club when that happens. Obviously, the golf course is an example here. What we can put in this sort of 1 in 50 year category, if you like, this area nearest the river is these lower value sort of more natural land uses, things like maybe woodland, things like potentially parkland, things like nature reserves. So we put these things near to the river so that when these reasonably frequent floods happen, lives aren't lost and business isn't potentially damaged. Going further away from the flood, we see that a 100 years flood takes in a little bit more area, or floods a wider area, but no extra land uses. A 1 in 500 years flood, so a very rare flood, does flood things like factories and business premises. Again, it's better to be flooding things like business premises than houses, because obviously, again, if you've got a flood warning coming, you can advise these businesses that are likely to flood, not for people not to come to work, for maybe the business to take action to make sure that as little property is damaged as possible. And a 500 years flood is very rare anyway. So this 500 years bracket is not going to happen very often. And what we'd make sure would be flooded would be business premises and certainly not people's houses. Outside of the potential flooding zone, we put things like, and the examples here are schools and town centres. And we make sure that these sort of things are located outside of any potential area which could flood. And these, again, these are examples, but you know, we could widen this up. You're not going to build things like hospitals or old people's homes or anything that is vulnerable near to an area that could flood. So in summary, this shows us where in an ideal world we should build various types of things around a river to avoid maximum amounts of impact. We put near to the river, we put more sort of natural land uses, low value land uses, golf courses, nature reserves, things like that. Moving away from the floodplain, we put business premises, warehouses, factories, things that, you know, don't have things like expensive carpets or people living in them to cause financial loss or loss of lives. And then outside of the potential flood area, we put homes and places where people might be living, schools where children might be, and hospitals where people might be recovering from illnesses and might be vulnerable. Okay, so we make sure that those kind of activities are in an area which could never be flooded. Now, while resource 4 shows us what would happen in an ideal world on a floodplain, resource 5 shows us how humans actually do use the floodplain in the real world. And it's a bit of a contrast in some cases from how floodplains are actually being used to what would happen in an ideal world. So remember, in an ideal world, we would keep these high risk sort of land uses away from the river. If we look at resource 5, we see that that doesn't always happen in every case. And we've got examples from all over the world of activities that are going on floodplains. Just to sort of to make sure you understand or clear what all these activities are, I'll just quickly run through them. So top left is Worcester in the UK, which is obviously a town in the United Kingdom, which has been built clearly, according to the photograph, on a floodplain. So if ever this river floods, it's very likely that this town's going to be damaged, potentially lives lost, potentially businesses and homes destroyed. The centre top is a place called Cuckmere in Sussex in the UK, and this looks like a sort of a wilderness type environment here. It looks like there's some pastoral farming going on here, some farming of cows, and clearly this would be acceptable on a floodplain. This is a low value land. Farmers going to have awareness if a flood's coming and can potentially move cows away from the area that's going to be impacted, and he's going to have a minimal impact. Top right is Warsaw in Poland, and what's being built there is one of the stadiums for the European Football Championships to be held this summer. Clearly, that's you know, a decision that we could question whether it's a good idea for them to build this stadium here. You know, if they experience heavy rain during the summer, it's going to be quite embarrassing for them as a country if, you know, football matches have to be cancelled or postponed or moved to a different venue because their venue's underwater. So that's what that is. Middle left is a place called Uttar Pradesh in India, and what we've got here is an Indian family who are washing their clothes in a river. And so this shows here how people use the river in this environment. It's clearly an LEDC. People don't have washing machines in their homes, and so they use the river for washing. Middle is Shanghai in China, where they've obviously built one of the world's biggest mega cities right on a floodplain. And again, the impact here of a flood would be huge. We've then got middle right is Thailand in Southeast Asia, and what these people are doing is growing rice. Rice is grown in what's known as a paddy field, which is a very flat piece of land which they cover with water. They allow to flood to a height of, well, you can see here, virtually sort of knee height. Rice grows very well when it is sort of semi-submerged, so they allow their farmland to be flooded to a small extent and grow rice on it. So clearly here the floodplain is being encouraged to flood, but to a small degree. If this then floods very badly, it's going to wash the whole crop away and be useless, but they do want a small flood to happen. So clearly this activity needs to take place in a floodplain. Bottom left is St Catherine's Dock in London, the United Kingdom, which is obviously a very high-end marina, very expensive boats. You've got very expensive luxury sort of apartments around the area. So clearly this is an area of high value. If this was to flood, you might expect some of these very expensive boats to be damaged and some of the very expensive apartments around it to experience damage. We've then got Bapard in Germany, bottom middle. Here the floodplain is being used for a caravan and campsite. I would say this fits in very well with the diagram of best use of floodplains that we saw in Resource 4. Just like a golf course, the owner of the campsite can be alerted if there's going to be a flood and potentially not take any bookings that week, potentially get people to move on and make the situation safe. It's low value land, and so okay, they're going to lose business for a matter of a couple of weeks, but in worst case scenario they could be compensated for this potentially. Finally, bottom right, it is potentially most worrying, is Olkiluoto, sorry if I've pronounced that wrong, Olkiluoto 3 in Finland. A little bit of internet research reveals this is a nuclear power station that's been built on a floodplain in Finland. Again, this could be most worrying. It is if this floods, could we get some sort of nuclear reaction, nuclear meltdown? Seems unlikely with modern technology. And would they have built, you know, I don't imagine an MEDC like Finland would have built something like a nuclear power station without having investigated the risks properly. But the untrained sort of immediate thought is that potentially, is this a hazard? Could this cause some sort of nuclear meltdown, nuclear reaction? And there's the potential problem there. So like with resource 2 and 3, it seems very likely that resource 4 and 5 are going to be linked. And the question that you will be asked will be about these two resources rather than just one. Because actually, of course, there is a strong link between these two. What you might well get asked is to compare how the theory and the practice compares. So you might be asked to say which of the nine diagrams best conforms with resource 4 or best fits with resource 4 or shows a good example of what's shown in resource 4. So you need to think about which of these is suitable. So clearly you'd say that Kirkmere, the example in the middle there at the top, that farming would be a good would be suitable as an activity on a floodplain, because a farmer can be moved. You'd say that probably Bapard in Germany, the campsite, would be a suitable activity for floodplain, again, because we can give the campsite owner warning and they can be moved on. You'd say that probably the example of farming in Thailand would be a good example in that needs to take place in a floodplain in order that rice can grow effectively. I guess the proviso there is that obviously they don't do it in an area by a river that is going to frequently flood. You'd probably say that the example in India, in Uttar Pradesh, would be reasonable to take place on a floodplain. That obviously you'd imagine this family don't live right by the riverside. They just commute there, if you like, to do their washing. It would be a different story if the camera zoomed out on the India example and we could see, you know, a village there of poorly built houses right on the floodplain. That would be a poor example of what to do on a floodplain. You might be asked the opposite question. You might be asked which of these is a very poor idea to be doing on a floodplain. And really, you could give any of the other examples. You could talk about how Worcester is, you know, a town in Britain that's going to lose a lot of business, a lot of livelihood, potentially even lose lives if there were floods. You could talk about how Warsaw might be a poor example of planning, building a brand new football stadium there for the Euros right on a floodplain, and this might be a very poor idea. Similarly, building a city as big as Shanghai, again, you feel like they're maybe setting themselves up for a big fall there in the future, if that ever floods. St Catherine's Dock in London, you in your answer might want to question the wisdom of building such luxury apartments and mooring such luxury yachts in an area that could easily flood. And finally, of course, we've talked about the possible impact of a flood in the Finland example. What if this nuclear power station was flooded? What would be the repercussions of that? So I think it's very likely you'll be asked which of these shows good practice, which of these shows poor practice. You might also be asked which, you know, of these nine activities, where on the floodplain hazard zoning map would you put them? You might, and almost a categorization, and you'd be asked to justify why. So you'd have to sort of do what we've just talked about, but say, I think, for example, a Bopard should go in the 1 in 50 years area, whilst Finland should go outside the 500 years flood risk area. And you'd be asked to justify why. So all the reasons we've talked about. Moving on to resource six, what we start to do here is build towards the final essay question that I'm sure you're aware you have to write. And just sort of skipping ahead slightly, you'll be aware that there was floods this year in Brisbane in Australia, and you will have to write a short essay on the best course of action in order to prevent future floods in that area. And resource six sort of helps you build towards that. There will be questions about resource six in itself, but it also gives you ideas which you can then apply to the final essay. So this resource is important in itself, but also for the final essay. Resource six gives you four completely different and diverse flood management strategies that could be applied in any situation. And it tells you a little about each of them. So I'll sort of overview them for you and add a little bit of extra of my thoughts. Top left, we've got monitoring. So there's constant monitoring, effective warning systems, and insurance allow floodplain development, and this will not reduce flood damage. What this is saying is by monitoring a flood, by looking at weather warnings, by using data satellites, by looking at monitoring stations like this one here in the picture, we can predict when a flood is going to happen, and we can evacuate towns, we can tell businesses to close for the week, we can take steps to ensure that the minimum amount of impact occurs. It also uses the word insurance. We can encourage people along floodplains to take out insurance policies. So, you know, to so that, well, look, we basically say to them, we're not going to stop the flood from happening, but take out insurance so that when it does, you can at least get some sort of financial compensation for this. The key here is that it says this will not reduce flood damage. So by monitoring, we accept that a flood is going to happen, and we're not going to try and stop it. What we do, though, is by monitoring, we save lives. So people are not killed. It's not sudden, and it's not unknown. The damage to property, to business, is still the same and is still significant. And by monitoring alone, we don't prevent any of that. Another strategy looks at what we've just looked at, and that is this idea of zoning, using different areas of the floodplain to do different things. It says dividing up the floodplain into different areas or zones based on risk of flooding. So the activities or buildings within the zones is regulated, and it can be enforced by law. So this ties in with obviously with resource four. We say, right, this bit either side of the river, immediately on either side, no building at all. This next zone, you know, this 1 in 50 year zone, we're going to allow some woodland, we're going to allow golf courses, whatever. This next zone, this 1 in 100 years zone, we're going to allow just business premises. And the key is it can be enforced by law. So you can say by law, it's not possible for houses to be built next to the river. Now, obviously, zoning is great in a place that's being developed. The problem with zoning is if we've already built somewhere and we've already built a city right on a floodplain, this is reasonably useless because, short of tearing the city down and starting again, there's nothing we can do about this. So zoning is great for a new development, for a new place, but for somewhere that's already existing, can we use it? Well, potentially, but only in a minimal way. We've then got two types of hard engineered solutions. It says drainage basin level and local level. So the first one, top right, hard engineered flood defences at the drainage basin level. So these are large scale defences that cover the entire drainage basin of that river. We talked about drainage basins earlier on. So this is a way of managing that whole basin for one river and trying to restrict water flow and flood damage in a whole drainage basin. And it really, you know, through the picture suggests that the way to do that is by building a dam. And it says building dams and reservoirs, and it can be multi-purpose. So by building a dam, we basically put a huge concrete wall across the river. That obviously will have the knock-on effect of creating a reservoir behind it, an artificial lake. It'll flood a vast area of land behind the dam. Now, that's a problem in itself, but that's managed. It's a known flood that's going to happen. We can, if there are people living in that area, we can move them years in advance of this happening. So the actual impact of building the reservoir, it can be quite minimal. What it then allows us to do is control the rate of flow of the river. So there will be floodgates on that dam, and we can choose to open them at times where there is not a lot of rain. But at times where there could be a flood, we close the gates on the dam, allow the reservoir to fill up, and prevent floodwater from getting downstream of the reservoir. So by building a dam, we can completely artificially control how much water flows through the river, and therefore we can in theory prevent there from being a flood. It says it's reservoirs and dams are multi-purpose. Of course they are. It creates a reservoir there which we can then use for recreation. We can charge people to, you know, use their boats on it and whatever, and it becomes a site of leisure. You know, people go and walks around it, all kinds of things. So we can recoup money. Of course, the biggest and best thing about a reservoir is we can generate hydroelectric power from it, from the dam. And so although dams are big, expensive projects, we can look to claim our money back over the years that follow through the sale of hydroelectric electricity. So dams have great positives. The final one is local level hard engineered flood defence, which is in the bottom right there. And it says we can construct flood defences in large and straightened channels. And we've got some JCBs here that are building some sort of flood wall. We can literally build a physical wall either side of the river that prevents places from flooding. It says we can deepen and straighten the channel. So literally take JCBs, start digging away at the bottom, widen the channel, cut out some meanders. All these things that can kind of speed up flow and increase the volume that the river can take. And obviously this means if we make the river wider and deeper, this means when heavy rain comes, there's more capacity for that river before it bursts its bank. Its hydrograph can have a much higher rising limb, a much higher peak discharge before it floods. And so that's of great benefit. Now the key with these local level solutions are obviously that they're considerably cheaper than the dam option, but they are what they say, they're local level. They can protect a town from flooding rather than the entire drainage basin. So what are you going to be asked to do here? It could be a number of things. The first is that you could obviously be asked to write some sort of comparison of these defences, pros and cons, positives, negatives, which one would you choose? But I think that's possibly unlikely because of the fact that you're going to have to really do that in your essay, and we'll talk about that in a few moments. But you could be asked to give an account of what's good and bad. If they do that, what's very likely is they'll question how sustainable you believe each of these approaches is. Now, sustainability is obviously in the title of this exam. It's a sustainable decision-making exercise, and so at some point they're going to want you to refer to this issue of sustainability. Now, you need to be very clear in your mind what sustainability is. And there are three aspects to sustainability, but the overall definition is that if something is sustainable, it meets the needs of a current generation without harming future generations in any way. So it means that we can do something now to solve a problem today that doesn't have a negative impact down the line. Now, the classic example of saying that is unsustainable is the motor car, in that it meets the needs of transport today, but it does not do it in a sustainable way. We cannot continue in this way forever. We'll run out of oil. Potentially, we'll have climate change on our hands. And so the motor car and modern transport is an unsustainable thing. Now, there are three aspects to sustainability. There is environmental sustainability, there is social sustainability, and there is economic sustainability. And to really hit the top grades, you need to be referring to all three in any answer that questions sustainability. So environmental sustainability is about the environment, of course. Are we doing something now that is going to have long-term damage to the environment? If we are, it is not environmentally sustainable. There's, of course, economically sustainable, which is the word economic refers to money. So are we doing something now that is going to cause future generations financial problems? Are we creating further problems for people, for the economy down the line? Are people going to lose their jobs? Are people going to be unemployed down the line because of what we're doing now? If that's the case, then that is economically unsustainable. Finally, I mentioned social sustainability. This is about people's lifestyles, the way they live their lives, the things they do in their leisure time, the jobs they do, or just people's lifestyles. And again, if we are doing something now that is going to damage people's lifestyles and damage society in the future, then that is unsustainable. Now, what you're very likely to be asked about these four methods is to write an analysis of which is the most sustainable or which is the least sustainable, or comparing the sustainability of each. So I'll quickly sort of review them now, talk about each one and talk about its sustainability. Clearly the monitoring is probably the most cost effective of these. In it's, I would say, it's fairly economically sustainable in that it's possibly cheaper than the others. By putting in early warning systems, these are the things that are not going to cost millions and millions down the line. In fact, by putting in insurance, we're being very economically sustainable. We're putting small payments down now so that it doesn't cost us a huge amount of money in the future. So I'd say that monitoring is a very economically sustainable method. It also has minimal impact on the environment, so it is environmentally a sustainable method, and it has very little effect on people's lives. It doesn't interfere and it doesn't cause problems to anybody. In fact, it's a helpful, useful thing to be doing. And so in terms of sustainability, monitoring ticks all the boxes. Zoning. Well, zoning is fairly cheap to do if we can, if it's an option. Like I said, if we've already got a big city built, can we really do it? But in terms of its financial cost, its economic sustainability is pretty good. All we do is say you can't build there and that doesn't cost us anything. We find them somewhere else to build. So the cost is minimal. It may cause social problems. It may be that people are upset by not being able to build in certain locations. But this is not a massive social implication, and most people will continue their lives unimpacted by this. In terms of the environment, it has no negative effect on the environment. In that we are not going to build in certain locations, but we maybe weren't going to build there anyway. In fact, it can even be of positive impact to the environment. If we're going to build things like nature reserves or woodland areas next to, or encourage woodland areas next to a river, then that is obviously has a positive impact on the environment. So zoning, again, ticks all the boxes and perhaps even offers us some environmental benefits. It's very sustainable. The issue of building dams and managing a base, a whole drainage basin, potentially is a little different. First of all, dams are very, very expensive. In some cases, they can take 20 or 30 years to build and can cost millions, if not billions, of pounds for large scale projects. That is a huge amount of cost to put down initially, and it's very likely that a local council or a government or an authority that wanted to build a dam would spread that payment over many years, and so there would be a long-term negative impact to the local economy, because obviously, you know, local schools, local hospitals aren't going to have the same level of funding because so much of the local money is being spent on the dam. And so there is potentially an unsustainable economic impact. However, the big advantage of dams is that long term they do actually make money. Of course, I've mentioned hydroelectric power. You can use the sale of hydroelectric power from the dam to generate income. And so it may be argued, and it may very well correctly be argued, that a dam in the long term is going to be the most economically sustainable, in that it's the only one that's going to create money, generate wealth down the line. In terms of the environment, the dam has potentially the biggest negative environmental impact. First of all, you've got to flood a large area for the reservoir, and that's very likely to be a rural area, very likely to be woodland or farmland or something like that. And so you've got to take the decision to destroy many habitats, large areas for wildlife, large green spaces, and that's obviously going to create an environmental issue. There's also been issues with controlling rate of river flows further downstream. the natural flow of a river will flood out toxins and any pollution in a river, and will take it out to sea and dilute it. If you then control the rate of river flow to a minimal amount, some of the pollution and sewage perhaps is not going to be washed away at the rate that you need it to. And so there have been a lot of cases where rivers have become highly polluted as a result of a dam being built, because they're not simply not washing away some of the unwanted toxins as quickly as needs to be. So you do generate some environmental unsustainability issues by building a dam. In terms of society, it's difficult to see an impact on people's lives. Okay, you may have to move people. I know some of you may have studied the Three Gorges Dam in China, which is a case where several hundreds of thousands of people have had to be moved because of the building of the Three Gorges Dam. So potentially there's a social impact. You destroy communities. You have to move people away from their homes, and that's not good at all. Once the dam's built, does it have a social impact? Potentially not. Some people like the look of them, some people don't. It could be a bit seen as a bit of an eyesore to some people. Other people, I've already said, quite like reservoirs. They go sailing on them, go walking around them. It's very much a personal thing. So you're going to split opinion in terms of whether they like it or not. So in terms of sustainability, probably the dam is the most polarizing. It's very expensive, but it generates income down the line. It's very environmentally damaging. And socially, we may have to displace people, which is a problem. Finally, you've got the local level solutions. Again, I'll run through the various aspects of sustainability. First of all, economic. It's often not very cheap at all to build local level solutions. Flood walls and widening and deepening can be expensive processes, and so there is an economic impact. And unlike the dam, these are not things that generate income further down the line. You still set yourself up for problems, you know, but if you're doing things like not insuring yourself, you are going to create economic difficulties further down the line. So I think that there is economically sustainable issues with the local level defences. Environmentally, they're also seen as a bit of a problem. By building things along riverbanks and in these floodplain areas, you destroy habitats, it can create problems with wildlife, and so, you know, you're building big concrete and metal structures in an area that was potentially previously natural, and that's going to create problems for plant and animal life, and so you create environmental difficulties. It may also be social problems. People don't want huge great flood walls through their town or outside their house. Okay, they like the safety that it provides, but, you know, are people's, you know, if someone's paid a lot of money for a house with a nice view, if you then put a huge flood wall along it, are they going to be particularly pleased with that? I suspect not. So you may create social problems. There is a social good with the local level defences, in that the public do feel safe with them. If somebody is concerned or worried that their house is going to flood, you build a big flood wall next to their house, and that problem goes away, and they will feel safe, and that is obviously a good for society. You know, society will feel good about that. So there's your range of sustainability covered. I think it's very likely they're going to ask you that. An alternative question could be to mix resource 6 up with resource 5. So they could show, they could pick out some of the pictures in resource 5 and say which strategy would be best at which location. And of course, you'll need to consider sustainability and the practicality of some of these solutions. So for example, in Uttar Pradesh in India, it's clear from the photo that this is an LEDC, a poor part of the world. What's not going to be acceptable there is the use of a dam. It's going to be expensive, and it's not going to be implemented there. Likewise, you'd probably think Thailand is the same, whereas somewhere like Finland or in Poland in MEDCs, or in London in the UK, these are places where we could consider the more expensive options, the drainage basin level hard defences or the local level hard defences. And so you need to think about which of these you could apply to those various situations. And then we come to our final resources, which is all under the bracket of resource 7. And it's all about flooding in Brisbane in Australia in January 2011. And we're given a whole raft of information, which I'll quickly go through. And then you'll very obviously, and I'm sure your teacher will have told you, you will have to write a short essay coming up with a solution for Brisbane. So Brisbane on the east coast of Australia in a region called Queensland. And it's one of the major cities of Australia. On the first page, we're given a map of Australia, where you can sort of see the distance from Sydney and from Canberra, so from some of the other major cities. We're then given some photos where you can clearly see sort of people looking at the floods, some houses underwater, clearly a lot of flood damage. We then got an extract from a news article, which I'll quickly read for you. It says, Brisbane hit by huge flood. Australia's third largest city is facing a massive cleanup as thousands of residents return to assess the damage caused to their homes by the biggest flood to hit Brisbane in decades. 11,900 homes have been hit by serious flood damage. Another 14,000 properties and 6,000 businesses are partially flooded. The death toll from the floods in Queensland has risen to 35. It's thought that the cost of rebuilding the city will reach $10 billion. Australian dollars, equivalent to £6.15 billion. The Queensland State Governor said the crisis presented Brisbane with an unprecedented challenge because of the number of people left living in the flood-ravaged suburbs. And then there's some key facts. It says that caused it. So high rainfall in the area caused by tropical cyclone Tasha. Okay, so the area was hit by a tropical cyclone, a hurricane. And that obviously brings with it high winds and storms. It says La Nina, which affects weather patterns in Australia, was the strongest since 1973. Australia experiences this effect called La Nina, which brings with it heavy rainfall, sort of periodically every few years. And the La Nina in 2011 was the strongest since 1973, so brought with it a high amount of rain. So we've got a tropical storm coinciding with La Nina, an effect that brings an unusually high amount of rain to the area. And this generated December 2010 was the wettest year on record for the Queensland region. So there'd already been a considerable amount of rain fall on the area. So the addition of more rain through the cyclone and through La Nina, the ground couldn't cope with it. It was saturated. It absorbed like a sponge absorbing water. It absorbed all the water it could, and there was nowhere left for the rain to go except washing off the surface and into the rivers very quickly. It also meant that reservoirs in the area were very full already from the wet December. By the time the hurricane came along with the La Nina, the reservoir could take no more, and so there was no more capacity to store water. It also says several recent years of drought had led to the reservoir being allowed to fill up during this time of high rainfall. And that's what we've just mentioned, the fact that this Wivenhoe Dam, which is upstream of Brisbane, had already been filled and was unable to take any more. So the continued high rainfall in January 2011 meant that the water had to be released from the Wivenhoe Dam, increasing the level of the Brisbane River by up to 10 metres, which is a considerable amount in some locations. So you got the two dry years before, or the recent years of drought, meaning that they wanted to store as much water as possible for a potential drought this year. They then got hit with the hurricane and La Nina, had to release all the water they'd been storing, and then added to the water that was then coming in, creating this pretty horrific situation. On the very final page, we have a map of the Brisbane area, and it shows us the particular parts of Brisbane which have been flooded in dark. It shows the areas that have been flooded by this event. Now, what you're going to be asked to do here is very clear. You're going to be asked to write an essay saying what should be done in Brisbane or in Queensland or in the surrounding area to prevent future events like this. And you'll be given a range of options, which will probably or almost certainly relate to the options in Resource 6. So you might be asked to say whether you think monitoring is a good option, zoning, hard engineering at a basin level, or hard engineering at a local level. And you'll need to analyse which ones do. Now, they will give you between 3 and 4 options, one of which could possibly be do nothing as well. And you'll be asked to make a decision. This is a decision-making exercise. You'll be asked to make a decision on which is the best. So that's the most important thing to do. Do make sure that you make a decision. Don't wash around the subject. Make a choice. I think that, you know, hard engineering solution, local level, is the best one. They will give you an essay plan. Stick to it, because the essay will be marked according to that plan. So it might say, pick your favourite option. Say why that is the best option. Say why that is the most sustainable. Tell me 2 bad things about one of the options you didn't choose. Tell me 1 good thing about one of the options you didn't choose. That's just an example, but that's what they might give. You must stick to that, because they will mark it according to those things that they've set. So you can almost treat the essay plan as 4 or 5 questions that they've broken apart for you, and you need to make sure that you address all of them. So if there's a plan, and there almost certainly will be, you must stick to it. You must also talk about sustainability, okay? So the things we just talked about, environmental, economic, social sustainability, You must be clear in your mind why the option you have chosen is sustainable and why the others are not. Okay, so why is yours the most economically sustainable? Why is yours the most environmentally sustainable? Now, what I'm not going to do is tell you the answer, because actually, if they give you three choices or four choices, any of them can be the correct answer. The credit is from justifying. So even if one of the options is do nothing, provided you create a decent argument for that, you can get full marks for it. So you might say that do nothing is, you know, the most socially sustainable. It doesn't alter people's lives. It's the most environmentally sustainable. It doesn't damage the environment. Okay, these are just examples. So whatever you choose can be the correct answer. You just need to make sure you can argue why it's sustainable and why it's the best option. Now, in terms of timing, you need to be spending roughly half of the exam time on this essay question. Now, there will be people who might advise you to do it first in that case and spend the first half on it. I would advise against that, because actually the other questions will gear you up for this final question and will set the scene for you, so that when you get to the final question, you've already been through a series of other questions that that get you there. But I would strongly advise that if you find yourself with, you know, 35 minutes to go, you start to make haste or start to work quickly through the question that you're on in order to have a good half hour at the essay. You can always, if the essay ends up taking you 20, 25 minutes, you can always go back and finish off the earlier questions. I would strongly suggest, though, that if you've written the essay in less than 20 minutes, you may have struggled to access the very top grades. Now, for the very, very top grades, you need to offer more information than is just in this resource book, and more information than I've given you. You need to have show clearly that you have studied these Brisbane floods. And so I would advise anyone sitting this exam to go away and do some further reading about the Brisbane floods. Why did they happen? What measures were put in place? What were the impacts? What flood defences already exist in this area? Because really, to go beyond a B grade and to access the very top, you need to offer me more information than is in this resource book. So, final question, essay question. Look to spend half an hour on it. There is no wrong answer. Pick the option that you think you can build the biggest case for. Analyze why it's a good thing, you know. And that's not listing things, but pick apart three or four really good reasons as to why that's the best option. You know, I picked the dam because it's going to generate hydroelectric power, and that's, you know, an economic good. It's a social good. I also picked the dam because it is peace of mind for people. You know, people know it's going to work. That sort of thing, rather than listing reasons. Okay, so pick your reason, identify why it's the best one, stick to the essay plan. If it tells you to, you know, give three reasons why you rejected another one, do that. Don't go off on your own and do your own thing. Make sure you stick to the plan they give you. And if you do all those things, you ought to be able to access the better grades. Thank you for listening. Hopefully this podcast has been useful to people. Thank you for downloading this. Thank you for listening. And most of all, good luck with your exam. Any more detailed questions, please see a teacher about that, and I'm sure they'll be able to help you out. Clearly, you know, in an hour, I can't have gone through absolutely everything that could come up in this exam. There is a great many more things, but what I've hopefully been able to do is provide an overview of what this all means and give you an idea of some of the things that they might ask you about this exam. Good luck on January the 24th.